Hi, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's Law School, and I'm joined by my colleague and friend, Mark DiGirolami, the associate director of the center, for another episode in our podcast series, Legal Spirits. Legal Spirits is a podcast series that addresses cases, ideas, and issues in law and religion. We have an archived set of past episodes on our blog, lawandreligionforum.org. That's one word, lawandreligionforum.org. You can find past episodes there. And today, Mark, we're going to switch gears a little bit from past episodes and talk about an event that the center is going to be sponsoring next week in Rome. This is the third meeting of our Tradition Project. The Tradition Project is a research project that we established 2 years ago to address, broadly speaking, the continuing role of tradition in law, politics, and culture.
Yes, the first component of the project 2 years ago involved the continuing role of tradition in law and politics specifically, and was keynoted by Michael McConnell of Stanford Law School, formerly Judge Michael McConnell of the Tenth Circuit, who really talked in his address about the role of tradition in constitutional adjudication and in common law adjudication.
Right, Mark. And I should say that if our listeners would like to hear Judge McConnell's talk, it's available on the videos page on the blog that I just mentioned.
The second component, which was held last year, was keynoted by Sir Roger Scruton and was really about tradition and culture, about the role of tradition in influencing, supporting culture. And that one, too, is available. That keynote is also available on our blog.
Yeah, and I should say, Mark, about these conferences, they're major events, if we say so ourselves. We have the public event, the keynote speaker, and then after that, we have 2 days of workshops with invited scholars who come and discuss readings on the conference themes. And I have to say, it's been a real pleasure doing these things.
It has been. It's been very enjoyable. It's been enriching. And it's been a nice chance, in addition to the actual substance, just to have a place for a scholarly community to come together to think about these kinds of subjects which are not generally or very often thought about in the academy more broadly.
Right. One has to say, even to raise the idea that tradition can be a valuable thing in the modern world is to put you in a pretty small group among academics in the West today.
Yeah, and I think that that was really part of the impetus behind this project, and I think it's worked out very well.
I think so, too. Okay, the first two events were held here in New York, but for our third event, we're taking the show on the road. We're going to Rome, and we're going to sponsor a conference there with our partner school, the Università Lumsa, and especially here we have Professor Monica Lugato, who's been with us from the beginning and will be helping us, and also Villanova's McCohen Center, which is run by our friend Mike Moreland. And this theme, the theme of this year's conference in Rome, is tradition in the global context.
And we're lucky to have Associate Justice Samuel Alito of the United States Supreme Court giving the keynote address, and he will address the subject of the conference. And just as in the prior two events, we'll have a subsequent series of workshops where we'll have a somewhat smaller group, which will have read a series of readings and we'll come together and discuss those readings.
Right. But I will say also we have an added thing this year, which is a response panel. We have some eminent European jurists and scholars who are going to respond to Justice Alito's paper.
Yeah, that's right. I had forgotten about that. So the public event will be the keynote by Justice Alito on the response panel. And then we'll have this private event. And what Mark and I thought that we would do today is just to give you listeners a sense of what will happen, at least with respect to two of the workshops at those private events. As I mentioned, those events involve reading and responding to selected readings that each of the people who run the workshops selects and disseminates and then prepares a little statement about various sub-themes within the overarching theme of tradition in the global context.
Good. Okay, Mark. So let's talk first about your workshop, the one that you're doing. What's the theme of that workshop?
Great. Mine is liberalism, nationalism, and populism.
Right. So themes that are very much on everyone's mind nowadays.
Yeah, I think that of the workshops that we're putting together, this one is the most overtly political in the sense of involving the contemporary political scene.
And right. Not partisan, political.
Not partisan, but addressing the role of tradition with respect to, explicitly with respect to political movements that are now in circulation. And so the readings reflect a relatively broad range of views concerning the current political moment in the United States and in the Western world, at least. And they also suggest different approaches to and understandings of tradition within these various sort of large-scale moments and movements that are going on now.
Like, for example, what large-scale movements are you going to talk about?
The range that I have reflects a kind of movement from left to right. The range of readings that I selected, part of those movements and moments involve the issue of liberalism, the continuing position of liberalism as a political force in the United States and in the West. So at one end of the range is the introduction to Yascha Mounk's recent book, The People versus Democracy. Yeah,
it's getting a lot of attention, that book.
It's getting a lot of attention, and I think Mounk's objective is sort of to sound the alarm bells about the disconnection of democracy from liberalism in various ways. And the book is written from a distinctively liberal progressive perspective and is explicitly partisan. It criticizes Trump over and again. It criticizes other conservative populist and nationalist leaders in Europe, like very critical of Hungary, for example. And he says, Mounk does, that the new populist movements are democratic but anti-liberal, that they tend to blame sources outside of the polity, generally immigrants, for problems at home. And then he goes on to offer a number of hypotheses about why liberal democracy has been stable in the past but might not be so in the future.
Okay, that's one.
So that's the first issue. And I should say, even in Mounk's book, you can see appeals to tradition. Mounk cites the founding fathers of the United States as wedded to a conception of liberal democracy that stands opposed to what Mounk sees are present threats.
Right, and well, actually, this has been one of the themes throughout the Tradition Project all along, which is, you know, people often counterpose tradition to liberalism. But actually, liberalism is itself a tradition.
That's right. And I think Mounk uses, now whether that's a rhetorical trick or whether he really does mean explicitly an appeal to tradition is perhaps a different question. But he certainly does talk about traditional politicians. And of course, he must mean something by the word traditional. So the question perhaps for our group will be what exactly it is that he means. So that's one reading. The second reading, moving kind of along the political spectrum, roughly from left to right, although as I think about it, you know, it might be that these traditional categories of left and right aren't so helpful, aren't so useful. But assuming that we go with these rough categories, I picked an exchange or a conversation between Michael Ignatieff and Mark Lilla. Ignatieff is a one-time Canadian politician and an academic. Lilla is an academic now at Columbia University and actually is a former teacher of mine. I've always found very, very interesting.
And I think we'd say both scholars on the left.
Oh, certainly. Both are certainly liberals, liberal progressives. But I think that they offer a different perspective on the current political situation in the United States and Europe than somebody like Mounk. And their conversation, they frame their exchange as a conversation. It's really a series of questions to Lilla, and it concerns the idea of the open society, the open society. This is a political and social ideal, I think, that favors variously things like dynamism, universalism, especially moral universalism, a focus on individualism, a focus on autonomous choices, a lack of national borders, and other similar sorts of ideals. It's associated with actually an essay in the 1940s by Karl Popper called The Idea of Open Society and Its Enemies. And so Lilla, in answering Ignatieff's question, notes a couple of things. First, he says, every society, in order to be a society, has to be in some sense closed. Second, he says, the idea of an open society was itself a product of the times. It was a reaction against what was perceived to be the overly closed nature of certain societies, perceived to be tribalistic or religiously self-contained, orthodox, whatever it might be. And so he says, liberals and open societies, they are made, not born. And so this is, I think, in order to counter the sort of the end of history kind of narrative that says, was associated with Francis Fukuyama, who says, look, everybody's going to be embracing the open society now that we've gotten past all of these nasty things of the past.
Yeah, that's going to come up in my workshop too, which we're going to get to.
Okay, good. So, and he has a number of other themes. He talks about the existence, the very existence of an open society, as with any society, presupposing an us versus a them. So I thought that the reading was interesting in as much as the idea that an open society needs to be something that is cultivated and transmitted across time is itself, again, a kind of tradition, a kind of tradition that Lilla is saying, look, people aren't just naturally, they don't naturally tend toward liberalism. It has to be cultivated over a series of years and intergenerational.
Right.
So that was the second reading. The third chapter or piece of a chapter is Yoram Hazony's new book, The Virtue of Nationalism.
Okay, now we're moving to the right.
And now I think we can firmly say, I don't know Yoram myself, but I don't think, given what I've read, that I would characterize him as a liberal.
Right.
Or at least a traditional liberal in the way that...
And he's trying to revive the idea of nationalism.
He's trying to revive the idea of nationalism. He discusses some fundamental issues about the nature of political order. He says social units, whether of the family or the clan or the tribe or the nation, reflect the desire of individuals to advance their own sense of self and interest at different institutional levels. And the foundational virtue for him in the account that we have really is loyalty and mutual loyalty. He says mutual loyalties are continually reinforced by hardships and successes. And these loyalties ultimately can be traced actually even to loyalty to oneself and to one's parents. So it's almost like a series of concentric circles that he builds to show the nature of political affiliation, which again is based on this idea of loyalty.
Okay.
So that's, again, moving to the right. The final reading that I picked was by Patrick Deneen, our friend Patrick Deneen, in his now fairly well-known book, Why Liberalism Failed. Obviously, also not a liberal, Patrick, but I picked the conclusion to his book because it offers sort of a different sort of political program in response to what he describes as the failure of liberalism than what Yoram Hazony offers. So while Yoram Hazony is talking about nationalism as the appropriate response, Deneen really argues that what is needed is a kind of non-ideological politics, that one that focuses on cultivating healthful practices.
So what are the questions that you think these readings raise that you'd like to discuss in this workshop? One or two of them?
Yeah, well, so I think one concerns the issue of tradition itself. Is tradition just a sort of plaything that one of these writers can use to advance or criticize any particular political project? Or is it possible to say something more substantive about tradition, that it isn't a plaything, that it really does mean a certain set of commitments? And one of the things that is talked about in Hazony's piece, actually, is that part of the ways in which a society preserves itself, one can tell whether an institution is healthy, is through intergenerational transmission.
Mm-hmm.
That itself suggests something, dare I say it, conservative about the nature of the political enterprise. And even for those writers that consider themselves on the left, I would have that question that I would ask, and I'm sure that there are others, but rather than go into that right now, let's talk about your workshop, Mark, and the readings that you picked.
Okay, well, my workshop is all about the conflict between tradition and human rights. And we chose this as a topic because it's a good example of the conflict between local tradition and a progressive global order. The conflict is typically described as a clash between universal human rights and local cultural traditions. And so the readings I assigned reflect a debate about which of these two approaches, a universalist approach or a local tradition approach, really is the appropriate way to think about these questions. And I assigned four readings. Two of the readings are general, and then two of the readings are a little more specific. The first reading I assigned is the very famous article, now 25 years old, from Samuel Huntington, The Clash of Civilizations. And in this article, Huntington famously wrote that, in fact, and this gets back to what you were saying, Mark, about the end of history, at the end of the Cold War, there were many serious people who said that Western progressive rights-based liberalism really was going to be the only viable social order and the only thing that was left for adoption. And Huntington said no. Huntington said that what progressives saw as universal values really were not shared by other civilizations across the globe, other civilizations with different histories and different traditions and especially different religions. And in fact, he said those purported universal values we're engendering resistance in other cultures. So obviously, if Huntington is right, and I should say it's a very controversial piece even now, then a universal human rights regime is bound to be problematic. In fact, it's bound to be a non-starter.
So how do you think the thesis has held up, Mark, after 25 years?
Yeah, well, this is controversial. Myself, I think it's held up very well in some respects. I mean, if you think Huntington's main point is that Western progressive rights liberalism is not going to automatically take over all of the globe, he seems to be right about that. And when he says it's going to engender resistance in other cultures, he seems right about that.
And how do you think the sort of fragmentation that we're seeing within Western systems, European systems, American systems, how would he react to that? Or how do you see his thesis sort of mapping onto the current situation in that way?
Yes. Yeah, so in that respect, obviously, he didn't predict that. I mean, he did treat Western civilization, Western liberalism as basically a static thing that was going to continue. We are seeing some fissures now in Western civilization, the things you're talking about, some others are talking about. Rise of populism, things like this. I'm not sure how much of a challenge that is to Huntington. Again, if you see Huntington's main point, that it was a response. Huntington's main point is that Western progressive liberalism is not going to be attractive to everyone across the globe, and we should not simply declare it triumphant in 1993. And that, I think, has been borne out.
It's not even triumphant necessarily within the culture that he thought it was going to be.
Right. In fact, it may not even be. Now, we'll debate about that. I mean, yes, there are some tensions in the West today, but, you know, there have been tensions in the West in the past, too. So we'll see. But yes, that's right. There are some tensions even within the West. That's true. The second reading I assigned is an excerpt from Marianne Glendon's History of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights called A World Made New. And Professor Glendon offers a defense of human rights universalism. She argues that where basic human values are concerned, cultural diversity has been exaggerated. She says we really do have agreement on basic human rights. She also says that universalism, even in the Universal Declaration, universalism has never meant uniformity. She says the idea has always been that local traditions would shape the application of universal human rights. Although local traditions, of course, can't completely deny those rights. So she has a more positive view of these things.
Now, I take it perhaps some of this depends at what level of remove one takes these sorts of agreements, right,
Correct.
Mark?
Correct. I mean, it depends how, with what generality you define the human rights. And another thing it depends on is who is going to decide whether a nation has gone past this discretion in defining rights according to local traditions. So although Professor Glendon tries to defend the universalist project, it's not clear that she's really able to do so. We'll talk about that in our workshop.
And in fact, I think maybe an underlying theme or an underlying tension, disagreement, is the tension of sort of universalism and localism and the issue of whether rationality or rational thinking can get us to one set or one even one fluid or malleable set of agreed upon rights.
Yeah, well, in fact, she says that in her book. She says if we give up the idea of universal human rights, then we are giving up on the hope, I'm quoting now, we're giving up on the hope that the political fate of humanity can be affected by reason.
Okay, that's big stuff.
That's big stuff. We'll talk about that. Now, the next two papers are sort of smaller, and one of them, I have to say, is mine. I took the privilege of the workshop organizer to assign my own paper. And this is a paper I wrote a couple of years ago. It's about human dignity. And my paper looks at the way that the concept of human dignity, which is central to many human rights instruments, including the Universal Declaration that we just talked about, actually is quite a contested subject. Everyone agrees on human dignity in principle, but when you interrogate what people mean by that term, you see that the agreement is really on the surface. People use the same word, dignity, but they mean very different things. And that's why human dignity is adduced in support of a variety of conflicting positions, both for and against same-sex marriage, for example. In the paper, I go through a number of these conceptions of dignity in different documents from the Catholic Church, from the Russian Orthodox Church, from the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and so on. And I focus on the conflict between rival conceptions of dignity in recent debates over so-called traditional values resolutions in international human rights fora.
Yeah, now, Mark, I take it that there's an analogy in this country in constitutional adjudication with respect to, for example, some of the ways in which Justice Kennedy used to talk about dignity, rights of dignity, and one could make similar sorts of claims with respect to the person who was resisting or objecting to those very same rights.
Right. So, I mean, I talk about this a little bit. I think Justice Kennedy's view of dignity is a kind of subjectivist view, that dignity means a person can assent to his authentic self, can create his authentic self on his own without the constraints of tradition. That's a very different understanding of dignity that then appears, for example, in a very famous Russian Orthodox Church document from about 10 years ago, in which the Russian Church says that dignity really means conforming oneself to morality, and morality means conforming oneself to traditional cultural norms.
Yeah, no, I think that those are completely different understandings, and possibly not just different, but conflicting understandings in some ways.
I think so. Now, we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about whether the Russian Orthodox Church position is genuine or just a pretext for supporting Russia in its diplomatic efforts to resist Western power.
I mean, I assume the same kinds of critique could be made about the ulterior motives for American support for it, their own subjectivist views, right? That this is just about American hegemony also.
For sure. We'll talk about that. The last reading is an excerpt from a scholar by Agajanyan, named Agajanyan, who says, actually, the Russian Orthodox Church's traditional values campaign really is of a piece with late Soviet rhetoric. He says it's kind of a Christianization of the late Soviet ethos. He also says that, Agajanyan says that, this to get back to the point you were making before, that really what's happening now is we have a culture clash not only across the globe, but actually within cultures themselves. He says, astonishingly, elements in the West have begun to challenge the progressive liberal ethos, he says, as displayed in the rise of the far right and the results of the 2016 American presidential election.
Yeah, and actually this idea in itself might challenge the notion that nationalism is in our future, because what we're seeing perhaps is the rise, if we're seeing fracture within nations and yet alignment that one can trace that parallels the sorts of alignments that are happening in a number of different places, then it looks like what's happening is that you have two or perhaps three or more sides that one can see reflected in within different nations across the globe.
Yeah, and that's actually what Agajanyan says, and I'm sure we'll talk about that actually in the workshop.
Yeah, very, very interesting.
Well, okay, that's it for now, folks. So we're going to go off to Rome and have a good time and talk about all these issues. We're going to take a break for Christmas, but we'll be back in January with some more podcasts. Meanwhile, as I say, if you'd like to find our past episodes, please go to lawandreligionforum.org. That's one word, lawandreligionforum.org, and you can find them all there. That's all for now. See you next time. Bye.